Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. Newly freed from prison, once convicted child murderer Damian Eccles appeared on our program 2 years ago and shared the troubling story of the flimsy case that sent him to death row. Arrested as a teen in 1993 and charged in the murders of three Arkansas 8-year-olds, Eccles faced the death penalty after a trial marked by faulty testimony and hysteria. The West Memphis Three became a cause célèbre and were finally released from prison following nearly 2 decades of public outcry, led in large part by our other guest today, Lori Davis, who learned about the case the same way most of us did, the HBO Paradise Lost documentary series. Davis and Eccles were married in 1999, with Eccles still on death row. They were reunited on the other side of the bars in 2011, when the West Memphis Three agreed to an Alford plea. Their epistolary love story, Yours for Eternity, is out now, and it's my pleasure to welcome Damian Eccles and Lori Davis to the roundtable.
Thank you so much for having us.
Lori, what was it that first attracted you to Damian, someone you'd never met before?
I saw Paradise Lost in 1996. I'm here in New York, and the film had a huge effect on me, as it did on most people who saw it. It was evident that there was a grave injustice that had happened in the community, in the trial and the investigation. And I'm from the South, and so I understood the culture. I was raised in a fundamentalist Christian home, and I was also I felt a kinship to Damian because I was kind of an outsider, always asking questions, a little bit of a rebel. And I just felt a need to reach out to him. I wanted to help him if I could. So that's what my first letter was an offer of help.
Most people saw the films and they found it very upsetting, and they kind of went on with their lives and kept the West Memphis Three in the back of their mind. But you really took it to another level. And I wonder what it was that kind of inspired you to sort of lead this fight over the years.
Well, it started out the first, of course, getting to know Damian and eventually falling in love with him. And you know, he is such a fascinating man. And the emotional component of our life together led me to realize that I had to take the next step, which was to start working on his case, because that was going nowhere. So I moved to Arkansas and started working with a lot of people. It ended up being a huge team in the end of lawyers and supporters, different experts and investigators. We raised a great deal of money. We had many people working on the case. And so it really was. I started working on the case in 1998, and we worked on it up until his release in 2011.
Damian, what did you think when you first heard from Lori?
I knew from the very beginning that this was someone that was completely and absolutely unlike anyone that I had ever known before. She was outside my frame of reference. I started receiving a bunch of letters from people all over the world just because of documentaries and the websites and stuff that were being released and put out. But whenever I heard from Lori, you know, it was just the way she thought, the way she carried herself. You know, she would see things in daily life, just mundane things that most people wouldn't even pay attention to, and she saw them in a way that made them seem really magical and thought-provoking. And it made me want to be able to see the world through her eyes, to see that much magic in daily life. And no one had ever really made me feel like that before. So I just had this feeling of I needed more. I craved more constantly. I wanted to hear what she thought and what she felt about pretty much everything under the sun. And no one had ever really made me feel that way before, so I knew that this was just something completely different.
Was there any apprehension, and I guess this question really goes to both of you, in terms of letting the relationship grow? Because certainly you were hopeful that one day you'd be released, but it was looking very bleak for a long time.
Well, we learned very early on something that we put into practice very strongly in our life is that your life will move in the direction that you focus your energy and attention in. So the way what we always did is we didn't focus on what we were scared of. We focused on what we wanted. You know, we always compared it to like whenever they train race car drivers to drive, they tell them, you don't look at the wall. If you do, eventually you're going to drive into it. Instead, you look at your instrument panel. You look at the other cars on the track. You look at the track itself. And that's what we did. You know, we never focused on the fact that I could be very well murdered by the state of Arkansas. We stayed away from that. Instead, we kept all 100% of our attention, 100% of our energy focused on nothing except each other and moving forward and moving towards the life we wanted.
But, you know, you're in a small cell. It's not a very healthy lifestyle. There aren't a lot of privileges. So how did you two grow together? I mean, obviously, we have the letters here and that they make up this book. But there has to be, you know, also a physical aspect, I would think.
Well, a lot of it really was you have to compensate for the things you don't have, you know, the things that people out here take for granted. You know, we couldn't go to the movies together. We couldn't go to dinner together. We couldn't sleep in the same bed together every night. So always compare it to, really as odd as it sounds, brain damage. You know, a lot of times if part of a person's brain has been damaged, the undamaged parts will start to form new connections to try to compensate for the parts that have been harmed in some sort of way, the parts that are lacking. And that's what we had to do. Since we didn't have so many things, we had to find ways to compensate for that. And it could be anything. You know, there were many, many things over the years. Just one thing, for example, that we wrote about in the book was we used to make what we call moon water, where every night, the night of the full moon, every month we would get a container of water and put it in the window so that it would catch the moon's reflection in it. And then every single night after that, for the rest of the month, both of us at the exact same time each night would take a sip from that container, just so that we both knew at that moment we were together doing the same thing. It was also, you know, just our spiritual practice was a huge component of tying ourselves together. You know, we both practiced meditation and energy work and visualization and all of these things that makes spirituality not some, you know, something in the clouds that you believe in at some future time, but the actual practical ways of putting it to work in your daily life and helping you make it through horrible situations. That was a huge part of what tied us together.
Well, now you have to tell us about your wedding, because it was highly unusual. I mean, first of all, it was a death row wedding, but also it was very ceremonial. I wonder if you could tell us your memories of that day.
As far as I know, it's still been the only Buddhist wedding ceremony in the Arkansas prison history. Over the years while I was in prison, I eventually received ordination in the Rinzai Zen tradition of Japanese Buddhism, which was the same tradition that used to train the samurai in ancient Japan. And Lori became affiliated with the Korean Zen temple in Little Rock, Arkansas. So whenever we did get ready for the actual wedding ceremony, we thought it be important that it was something that meant, you know, something to us, not just empty form, you know, not something you just rush through in order to get the marriage certificate. We wanted it to be deeply meaningful to us in that way. So we had a Dharma teacher from the Korean Zen Buddhist tradition that performed the wedding ceremony. We were allowed to have six people there, just six people. And that was actually the day that we were married was the very first time that we ever actually physically touched each other.
Lori, did your friends and family think you were nuts?
I kept this really close. I didn't share this with a lot of people, mainly because I didn't particularly want to hear their opinions about it. I knew, you know, that was a concern for me, and I didn't have the time or energy to deal with it. So I told my closest friends, and they were supportive of me. I'm sure they were worried, but they were very respectful of my decisions. And I waited to tell my family for 4 years. I didn't tell them for 4 years. I told my parents about a couple of months before Damien and I got married. And by that time, we had established a life together, and I was working on the case. And so I was able to go with it to them with a little more substance and stability than it had it been in the beginning of the relationship.
I want you to tell us what the, you know, more than decade of fighting the courts and mobilizing public support and having to raise money was like while you were working just so hard to get Damien out.
It was extremely difficult because most of the time I was working a full-time job just to support myself, and then I would come home, and it was almost like having two full-time jobs. there were so many people had come on board to help us. And so they helped me. I had a lot of help, I should say. I had, so many people cared about this case and the injustice and came forward to help financially and support us in other ways. But it was really a huge effort. And there were times in where years would go by and no progress was made. And those would be times of great despair for both of us, and we'd have to get through the, it was just horrible. And then all of a sudden there would be, you know, DNA was discovered that matched someone else, and there would be, from that point on, it got better. But still you're talking about 4 years, which is a long time to wait for the whole thing to turn around. So it's complicated, it was hard, it was emotional, it took a toll.
Take us back to the day a couple years back now, which it all happened in a hurry to the outside world. Of course, you two had been waiting, you know, a couple of decades for this final settlement, an Alford plea. And here you go, Damien's out after all this time.
It wasn't, as these things tend to go, I think, it wasn't anything as we had envisioned it. We knew he was going to get out, but had no idea how it was going to come about. So I get a phone call from Damien's lawyer, and he says to me, "Lori, Damien may be getting out in 3 days." It ended up being about 9 days. But so I immediately just went into shock. I remember it, and I had to tell Damien that day. And so there were the two of us who were in shock and just trying to get through the next few days, preparing somehow for him to come out. We didn't know where we were going to go. We didn't know where we were going to live. How we weren't prepared for it. And so I think in some ways maybe that helped, because we didn't have a lot of time to think about how this is going to happen. We just we were free falling, and we were caught every time. We had caring people around us who provided us with a place to live and with some resources until we could, you know, get our feet under us. And we started working and started making a film and Damien's book. And so there was a lot going on in that first year, almost whirlwind-like.
Damien, did you have any concern that, you know, you two had built a life as much as you could between the bars, but now that you were free, I have to imagine there's a certain level of getting to know each other all over again.
Maybe on some level. It wasn't really that great, though. I mean, it wasn't that big a deal. It wasn't that huge a thing. Most people automatically think it's going to be a huge difference, and it wasn't. I mean, just because we had been together for so long and we knew each other so deeply in ways that most people never get to know each other even when they're living in the same house. So that whenever we were finally physically together, it was just like sort of adding a new level, a new layer, and a very subtle layer. You know, it was just like... suddenly I'm just spending more time with the person I've been with for all these years. It wasn't a huge transition in our relationship. It was more a transition in just trying to adapt and adjust to the other aspects of life. That was the hardest part.
What do you guys want to do now? I mean, here you have a huge, massive change, I'm sure, in the outlook, in the way that you're looking at, you know, what's possible. And I just wonder, you know, what do you guys have planned?
I think I'd lived a very creative life before I met Damien, and I think we both feel the same. We want to live creative lives, do creative projects, and move into that part of life rather than, you know, dealing with strife and despair and the legal system. We're looking forward to a life of great creativity, I hope.
Yeah, we're both really interested in different aspects of the art world, the art realm. You know, just for example, Lori, one thing that she's pursuing right now, she's writing, but she's working on a screenplay instead of a book. For me, the thing that I'm the most interested in right now is photography. That's the art form that I'm following up, learning more about, exploring and developing. But at the same time, both of us still have a really deep connection and love for the spiritual practice that got us through that time period in our lives, you know, the meditation and the energy work and everything else. So we do classes on that sometimes. We teach people the same things that helped us survive a very horrific time period in hopes that they'll be able to put it into practice in their daily lives and get some use out of it.
Are you in touch with Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly, who were your fellow defendants in the case?
I'm in touch with Jason. He lives in Seattle now on the other side of the country. I live in New York. He lives in Seattle. We text each other. We email. Jesse, on the other hand, he only had an IQ of about 68 to 70 to begin with. And then whenever you add all of this trauma to that, they've pretty well made sure he will never live anything even remotely resembling a normal life. From what I've heard, he doesn't have any contact with anyone. He lives in the exact same trailer park in Arkansas he lived in when he was arrested. He lives with his dying father. And from what I've heard, he doesn't even have a telephone. He has sort of just severed himself off from the outside world.
Hmm. Your case, in many ways, is still open. Now, technically, you three have pleaded guilty but are out free. So you can kind of wrap your head around that catch-22 for a while. But the last time we talked, you said that, you know, you were still pumping away to find out, you know, who actually committed these crimes. And I wonder if you have an update for us on that.
Really, everything we've given, we were told by the prosecutor that he would be more than willing to look at any new evidence we brought forth. And so far, that's proved to be completely and absolutely untrue. They refused to look at it. Probably what's going to end up happening, I mean, it took 18 years for us to get this far. So we know it's not going to happen overnight. We know it's one of those things. It will happen eventually. Our names will be cleared, and we believe the person who actually belongs in prison will be in prison, but we know it's not going to happen overnight. Probably what's going to end up happening is the people who have a vested interest in keeping this covered up, like the prosecutor, the attorney general, the judge who's now a senator, what's probably going to have to happen is these people are going to have to either retire or be voted out of office, whatever it takes to get new people in those positions who don't have an interest in, you know, covering up their part in what happened. That's what'll have to happen before the case finally moves forward.
What's the best part of being out?
Honestly, it's most people would think it's the things like being able to eat what you want or being able to wear what you want or go wherever you want. But really what it is, when you're in prison, when you're in that situation, you live in fear 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You've always, always got somebody who wants to hurt or kill you, execute you, make you miserable in some sort of way. So just the fact that you get to go through a day without having to worry about something like a guard caving your skull in with a nightstick, not having to live with that fear hovering over you constantly, that's the best part.
Well, Damian Echols and Lori Davis are the authors of Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row, and it's out now. It's their letters back and forth through Damian Echols' long time on death row, and it's just been a pleasure to have both of you on the roundtable. I wish you good luck in whatever comes next. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.